Hello and welcome to the latest podcast in our series, Living with Diabetes, brought to you by Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. In this edition, we're talking cycling, fitness and fundraising, plus an update on COVID-19. Cameron Muir talks about living with diabetes and the challenge he's taking on later this summer.
The biggest challenge will be getting to the bottom of the Northumberland Hills and looking up, thinking I've got a couple of days of this. I liked on the TRWF website, you could see the price of some of the research that they were doing, and that would kind of originally set us a goal of what we wanted to raise, so we could see where our money is going there.
We hear about the work of the John Pound Centre in Portsmouth. Like many charitably run community and fitness facilities, it has struggled through the pandemic and is planning a staged reopening. We hear about the support they provide to people living with diabetes.
Okay, so the Healthy Hearts and Diabetes events, we had the lovely Asmina on board to do cookery demonstrations, as well as a number of other speakers to give advice. Again, we were strongly supported by DRWF and other organisations, and they really made the day what they were.
There's been a lot of attention on why the Black, Asian and minority ethnic communities appear to have been so badly affected by COVID-19. We hear the latest insights on this from Professor Kamlesh Kunti.
There are more people within the National Health Service, for example, who work within the frontline are of Black minority health populations. Also other key workers such as drivers, such as people working in the food industry. So there's a number of factors that are probably working together.
Plus, we hear from former Commonwealth Games road race cyclist Roddy Riddle and how he's managing his type 1 diabetes.
I was in school with some people that were type 1, and they used to go to the toilet to find out what their blood glucose levels were. I'm lucky enough to be a Dexcom warrior. I've got all the fancy tech, so I'm really grateful for that.
I'm Claire Levy from DRWF, the host of our monthly podcast, Living with Diabetes. Scotsman Cameron Muir works in the financial sector in London and is planning to cycle all the way back to his family home in Edinburgh at the end of August. He lives with type 1 diabetes and told me about his diagnosis almost 20 years ago when he was just 10 years old.
Yeah, I remember being around at a friend's house, kind of boasting about how much food I could eat or water I could drink with it or whatever. And I started to lose over that week. I lost a lot of weight. And not that I really noticed it being a 10-year-old, but I think my mum noticed it quite badly. We were actually in Loch Lomond, near Stirling, in Scotland, on a little trip with some family friends, and two of them actually are in the kind of medical industry. One of them is a quite successful surgeon. The other one is quite successful in being an eye doctor. And they knew something was off. I was particularly ill that night, couldn't sleep, and was basically a stick. Didn't have anything on me, just skin and bones. And I was actually rushed to a small doctor's in Stirling, actually, who checked for ketones, and I'd identified that I was clearly had a very high blood sugar, and it could possibly be diabetes, or pretty much it was definitely diabetes. I was rushed to Aberdeen Health Hospital, and they sorted me out with some insulin and on various different drips to get me going again. But over the last 20 years, it's really changed. I mean, from going from little kind of bottles and actually using syringes to pull insulin out of the little bottles and injecting myself three times a day, and there would be a set amount that you'd inject. Now I'm very flexible on what I inject. I probably inject about 10 to 12 times a day, which sounds like a lot, and it sounds... it sounds difficult, but it's much better for me to control how I feel and my blood sugars if I inject and ensure that I'm taking the right amount of insulin. So that's how over the last 20 years that it's kind of impacted me and it's really changed.
Bit of a shock for your family as well, was it?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was my mum was obviously very, very worried and driving me from Loch Lomond, rushed me back to Aberdeen herself because they couldn't wait for an ambulance. She decided to do it herself, but very worried, and I was okay. So
so
So as you say, things have changed a lot. So how does diabetes technology help you today, and what difference has it made?
So one of the things that I decided that not to do, and I know a number of people have typically, you know, moved on to the pump, especially after living with diabetes for that many years. And obviously there's an insulin pump you can get now, where you basically can feed yourself insulin and through kind of a wire that fits inside you, and kind of program it to give you the insulin on a slower drip feed or whatever, and depending on what you're doing. I decided not to go with one of those, basically for the main reason that I wasn't sure that I really wanted to be attached to something. But I mean, everyone has their own preferences. I just quite like having the insulin in a kind of EpiPen that I carry around. But yeah, so that technology is going on, and I think they're developing it. And I know the last time that I went to the hospital, they had a new kind of pump, which could be a much smaller device, and they were trialing it on a few diabetics, and I was quite interested in doing that. But one of the main pieces of tech that I have is the Freestyle Libre sensors, which I think are have like changed my life in terms of my diabetes massively. I can use my phone to just scan over a little 2p size sensor that sits on the outer side of my skin, and it basically, you know, it would tell me where my blood sugar is and where it's going because of how it's reading it.
I think they are amazing, aren't they?
Yep, they are. They really are. You can do so much on that app. But I mean, these are the kind of things that these tech companies are working on that are just changing people's lives and lifestyles.
Mm. So who inspired you to take on the challenge, the cycle challenge, and why?
Yeah, you call it a challenge. I mean, I didn't say it previously, but you know, I mean, it's 600 kilometers that we're doing over 16,000 feet over a course of 7 days. But one of the other reasons of kind of doing it, so through diabetes is one thing, but my grandmother sadly passed in April this year, and she was a huge supporter. She was 93, so she lived a long life. She was a huge supporter of charities, especially diabetes, and she basically, you know, she would always kind of send me these little newspaper cutouts saying how we were getting a cure in a few years. She would send me a number of these newspaper cutouts on a kind of weekly, monthly basis. And she used to also donate a lot of money, both for the British Red Cross and for diabetes in Aberdeen Hospital, Diabetes Research at Aberdeen Hospital, I found out recently. She's kind of inspired me to take this on, and I'm doing it in memory of her in a way.
Nice. So, yeah, the recent government drive to get people out there on their bikes, do you think that's good for yourself and for other people to increase their activities?
I think during this lockdown phase, people have found new things to do. We've been doing everything under the sun in terms of baking or going out on the bike or doing anything to get outside or do something new. At the moment, there are lots of people out on the bikes and people are picking up new things. So it's great to see, because I've been kind of involved in sport since a very young age. Played rugby all the way through the kind of early part of my life, and then kind of picked up some more kind of less sporty, but probably more like cardio version, cardio kind of things. And yeah, as I'd say, as like a diabetic especially, it's interesting to understand how your diabetes moves with this, and actually doing some, you know, moves with the sport that and the kind of training that you're doing. And yeah, I think typically all diabetics shouldn't be scared of going out and doing sport. Just be conscious of your blood sugar movements.
And we'll hear more from Cameron and his forthcoming challenge later in the podcast.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
You're listening to Living with Diabetes, a monthly podcast from DRWF. The John Pound Centre in Portsmouth is typical of many charitably run community and fitness facilities across the UK. It has struggled through the pandemic and is now planning a staged reopening.
I spoke with Rebecca Spencer, the Healthy Living Coordinator, and Matt Mason, the Centre's Director, just before the lockdown happened, to hear more about the support they provide to people living with diabetes.
Well, the John Pound Centre is a community centre, but we tend to call it, I tend it more really, a hub for the community. So going back, we've been here about 15 years now, and the principle was going back that there was lots of local services that were scattered around Portsea and were operating out of different spaces, and most of the spaces probably weren't appropriate anymore really for the service. So John Pound Centre was created in consultation with local residents, and all the key facilities or services that were wanted or already running in the area were all pulled into this one building. So within this centre now we have the youth service, the library service and the housing service for the local area. We have a large main hall and sports hall, which we run anything from community activities, yoga, badminton, short mat bowls, through to conferences. We have a fitness suite upstairs, so that's where we deliver our healthy living scheme that I think we'll probably talk a little bit more about. And then we have some training space and pottery space along there. So really, the aim of the centre is to serve the local community, and if we haven't got a service here, is to try and find that service and get that to come to the centre and help residents.
And what are the aims and goals of the centre, would you say?
So we've got four main streams, health and wellbeing being a real strong one that tends to run through everything that we look to do here. So we've got health and wellbeing, we've got social, so it's really important that we create a social environment and a friendly environment for our local residents to engage with and to do a number of activities, or really just to come and meet and get involved. Employability. So again, we try and champion employability for local residents. So anything from apprenticeships through to work experience. We've got quite a large volunteer program, so we are helping young people particularly to try and get back into work or to get onto the work ladder really, or to retrain or do some more training. And we have our social projects, so that's really, we have things like food cycle projects, gardening projects, which again is about engaging with local residents, and really that health and wellbeing stream goes through all of those.
And you're working in partnership with DRWF, and in the last few years you've done a number of events. Can you just let us know what you've done around type 2 rehabilitation and prevention?
Okay, so we've had lots of support, and we'll talk about a bit more in a minute, but we've done the Healthy Hearts and Diabetes events here, which DRWF has strongly supported us, and we couldn't have done it without them. And also, we regularly meet with Lee Callendine, and just to keep us updated on what's going on both sides, so what we're doing or planning and what is going on your end. We have the newsletter delivered to us so that we can see all the good work you're doing as well. And we find these meetings useful to plan, you know, things that could possibly come off in the future. Like we said, that we also support your wellness days as well.
How useful have you found those?
Absolutely brilliant. I think we've been 3 or 4 years now, and it's just such a brilliant event. It's so well run. The networking opportunities is fantastic. We've made strong links with people that we wouldn't have come across if we hadn't have gone to the wellness days, and meeting the attendees as well. Some that are not necessarily going to be coming to the centre because they're out of the area, but getting a good perspective of what's needed, and the bigger picture of and wider area of what's going on. We've also had some referrals from the wellness day. So all round, it's a fantastic event.
So not only attendees, you've made good collaborations with other exhibitors.
Absolutely, yes. And ongoing, not just sort of one-offs, organisations that we now work with. So it's fantastic.
That's really good to know. So coming back to the Healthy Hearts and Diabetes events, can you just tell us a bit more about these? And what's in the diary for 2020?
Okay, so the Healthy Hearts and Diabetes events, we ran two of these events, and we had the lovely Yasmina on board to do cookery demonstrations, as well as a number of other speakers to give advice and knowledge on issues surrounding sort of healthier hearts and diabetes. We had really good attendance for these events, and the feedback was really positive. Again, we were strongly supported by DRWF and other organisations, and they really made the day what they were. These days were funded, so we're always looking for funding to host these days again. But we have planned in for 2020 to increase our support for the Diabetes Kitchen, and also for referrals for diabetics into our exercise program, where we have a specialist that can help them with tailoring a specific exercise program for their needs, as well as lifestyle support and weight management. So it's really positive.
So what is the Diabetes Kitchen? I don't know about that.
Well, the Diabetes Kitchen, that's a free course for anyone with type 2 diabetes that's not on insulin. It's a four-week course, and it's meeting and sharing with others living with diabetes and cooking some diabetic-friendly recipes, as well as giving hints and tips and information along the way. I think we're on our third course now, and it's going so, so well. The feedback has been amazing, and the guys that run it, David and Trevor, are doing a brilliant job.
Are there other centres like yours around the UK?
Throughout the UK, there are other centres that do offer the things that we do, but we like to feel that we're pretty unique in what we can offer.
So how would people, what's the best way if they are in your area to find out what's going on, how they can get involved?
Well, we have our website, www.johnpoundcentre.co.uk.
Fantastic. Are you still doing the exercise on prescription?
Yes, we are. That's really increased over the last few years. Mm. It's a strong scheme. We now take referrals from all over the city as well as outside of the city. And it's a steady stream. And especially with people with diabetes, the referral is on the increase.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
There's been a lot of attention on why the BAME, Black, Asian and Minority Ethnic Communities, appear to have been so badly affected by COVID-19. To discover the latest findings on this, I've been speaking to Kamlesh Kunti, the Professor of Primary Care Diabetes and Vascular Medicine at the University of Leicester.
So this was a surprise, a complete surprise to us. As you know, in Italy, in Spain, in China, this wasn't reported. For the first time it was reported was in the UK. And since then, there's been a number of studies, all showing from US and UK, that Black minority ethnic health populations are more affected. The reasons for this are very, very complex. One of the key reasons is that the people who have been affected with COVID-19 have certain chronic conditions, such as cardiovascular disease, hypertension, diabetes. They're more prevalent in these populations. And those who have these conditions also are at risk of getting hospitalization and dying from COVID as well. And we know these conditions are also more common in Black minority ethnic health populations. But besides that, we know that these populations are more obese. Again, obesity has been shown as a risk factor. And they live in more multi-generational families, live in more deprived areas. And another thing is they have key roles. So there are more people within the National Health Service, for example, who work within the front line. Are of Black minority health populations. Also other key workers such as drivers, such as people working in the food industry, they're also more likely to be from the Black minority ethnic health background. So there's a number of factors that are probably working together.
So it's definitely very complicated. What advice would you then give to people trying to improve their health in these situations? Are there some simple things to consider?
And the first thing is that we must listen to all the advice given regarding reducing risk. This is for everyone. This is about the 2 meter rules, about face masks, about hand hygiene. Those are very, very important. If you go into a household, multi-generation family, you need to ensure that you have you clean the bathroom after you've used it, you've got separate towels. And then besides that, I think we've seen that obesity is a risk factor. Trying to ensure that you're having a good diet, you're exercising, you're trying to keep yourself fit, because there's some early data showing that being unfit is also a risk factor as well. And these are the other common things. Now, if you are suspected of having symptoms, then definitely have the test done. And then if you're tested positive, to ensure that people who come into contact with you are also traced, possibly tested if they have symptoms, or isolated as well.
Is there more research needed to fully understand the reasons for the BAME community being adversely affected?
Well, NIHR and UKRI have funded a huge amount of funding recently on 6 projects, but there are others as well, to try and determine what are the key risk factors. We know some of them, but there's a lot of unknown, and I think over the next 12 months we will get more data in this issue.
It became clear within a few months of the COVID-19 outbreak around the world that men over the age of 70 were more often affected by the virus. Can you explain why?
We don't know the exact reasons, but we know that it's not just men over 70. Men per se were at higher risk, but elderly were so as well. And the key reasons for this are not known, but it may be because of potential risk factors that men have, smoking, cardiac disease, etc. Elderly, they're more frail, they're not as resilient as younger populations. We know influenza affects the elderly more, but in this case, SARS-CoV also was affecting elderly more, but even more so in terms of men who were elderly.
Is there any other advice you can give us at this moment?
I think I have never seen research change at such a pace in any area. And so this is a moving field. Every week we're learning new things. And I think just keeping up to date with whatever new research is coming out.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
You're listening to Living with Diabetes, a monthly podcast from DRWF. And we turn now to another Scotsman and cyclist, Roddy Riddle. He represented his country in the road race cycling event at the Commonwealth Games in 1994, coming a very credible ninth. 14 years later, at the age of 40, after his international cycling career, he was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. He's actually been running a cycle shop in Inverness for over 30 years and has seen a surge in cycling in recent months, a sport that's being encouraged in the UK to help people improve and maintain their fitness. So I asked Roddy about his recollections of being diagnosed in 2008.
Yeah, I lost almost 3 stone in the space of 6 to 8 weeks. I had an unquenchable thirst and was constantly going to the toilet. So, yeah, my wife got really concerned about the weight loss. So she was heavily pregnant with our youngest boy, Finlay. So she went online and did a bit of research, and it looked like it could be type 1 diabetes. So she got a home self-testing kit, and I did the test, and yes, it looked like I was type 1 diabetic, and I was diagnosed almost the same time as Finlay was born.
Crikey. So what was your life like before diagnosis?
As I say, we've got the cycle shop, which is 32 years old. We opened on the 7th of November 1988, and had a very successful international cycling career. So very, very sporty before being diagnosed.
So did you feel angry or depressed? You know, how did it make you feel, this diagnosis?
I'm a very positive person, so it didn't upset me at all. I did a bit of research myself when I did the self-testing, that I realised it was something that was controllable if you were willing to control it. And as I say, I'm a positive person, so I've not let it change my life at all in any way.
That's certainly true. And your motto is, rule diabetes, don't let it rule you. What do you mean by this, and how have you adapted to type 1 diabetes?
Well, the motto's there to prove that it shouldn't stop you achieving your dreams and goals in life. So, as I say, it's not affected my life, and that's why I do some of the crazy ultra marathons that I do, to prove that it shouldn't stop you achieving your dreams and goals in life, especially for people that have been diagnosed when they're younger. I class myself as a very lucky type 1 because I had a successful cycling career and everything before being diagnosed. And I wasn't diagnosed and I didn't have to go through childhood and teenage years. So I really feel for kids that have been diagnosed early. So that's why the motto is there, to prove to them that it shouldn't stop you achieving your dreams and goals in life.
You're an Ipsomed, Ipso insulin pump user. And how has diabetes tech helped you?
Oh, unbelievable. As I say, I was in school with some people that were type 1, and they used to have to go to the toilet to find out what their blood glucose levels were. I'm lucky enough to have been made a Dexcom warrior, so I get Dexcom G6 supplied, gifted from Dexcom. So I've got all the fancy tech, so I'm really grateful for that.
Makes a difference, doesn't it? And just looking at your amazing activities since diagnosis, you completed the 230k Trans-Saharan Marathon des Sables, which is reputedly the toughest foot race on earth, and you've completed the Arctic Ultra Marathon. How did you manage your diabetes for these gruelling events?
It was a lot harder in the Arctic. The Arctic Ultra Marathon made the Marathon des Sables actually look a bit like a park run, because it was 352 miles, which is 567 kilometres. And I did the whole thing in 6 days, 21 hours, with a total of 18 hours sleep. So very sleep deprived. At one point, my phone decided it didn't like the cold with 150 miles to go. So you had to take three pairs of gloves off and try to get blood out your fingers to do a blood glucose test. So it was a lot more difficult than running in the Sahara, to be honest.
What about in training? Do you rely on a dietitian or anything when you're in training?
I do have a dietitian who helped me with my attempts in the 6633, which was the Arctic Ultra, called James Moran. And he's one of the top sports dietitians in the UK. He actually works with the UK NUS cycling team, so there's no one more experienced than James to help me out. But during my training and stuff, no, I just look after my own diet.
You've been doing it a long time.
When I was first diagnosed, it was almost still taboo to do sport, and I didn't accept that. So my wife, Lynn, ordered a treadmill for me so I could do training in the garage, but in a safe environment. So if something happened with my blood glucose levels, I wasn't away from home. I could just go into the house and get glucose or whatever. And I keep a diary, and I've kept the diary ever since I was like 13 for my cycling. And I've continued that with my type 1, where I'm almost building my own Haynes manual on my type 1 diabetes, where if I'm doing a run, I can look back at a previous run that was similar and see what worked. So I think it's really important. I mean, you've got all this stuff that you can download, but I still think it's very important to keep a diary if you're doing sport.
Lots of people with type 1 are worried about doing sport because of hypos. Have you got any sort of hints around that that you can share?
Yeah, I would maybe join a gym for maybe 2 months so that you can keep a diary, learn about your type 1 diabetes and what exercise does, and then build up your confidence so that you can go into the outside world and do it in. But again, try to cover all eventualities. Like, I don't go anywhere without glucose tablets, and if I'm doing a big ultra marathon, I carry backup insulin pens. So I try to cover all eventualities of issues going wrong.
And just obviously as well, for people living with type 2 diabetes, exercise is very important and can really help with air control.
Absolutely. You can almost guarantee that if you do exercise as type 2, you're going to benefit totally from everything. Exercise is by far the best medication available.
And starting small, you know, it's not all about suddenly thinking I'm going to do an ultra marathon, is it?
Definitely not. Even if it's doing 9 holes in a golf course, if it's just going for a walk jog for 15 minutes, I would definitely not recommend just jumping in at the deep end, and because then you're increasing your chances of injuries and stuff like that. So start small and have goalposts as well, because if you don't have goalposts, then it makes the training far harder. So have a couple of goalposts in a year that you want to achieve, and it definitely makes getting out of bed in the morning to do your training easier.
Mm, maybe have a buddy.
Definitely. That does no harm whatsoever as well. I mean, I do a lot of my training on my own, but I know a lot of people that like to have company when they're doing their training. When I'm out on my own, it's my thinking time. So that's why I like to do it on my own. But yeah, it wouldn't do any harm to have a training buddy.
And any other hints and tips that you'd like to share, Roddy?
If you're taking up sport, first thing I would do is go out there and buy a diary and start building up your own Haynes manual. Set goals and don't let type 1 diabetes change you, and don't let it stop you achieving your dreams and goals in life, because it shouldn't.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
You're listening to Living with Diabetes, a monthly podcast from DRWF. And our thanks to Roddy Riddle for sharing his story. So to finish, let's return to Cameron Muir to hear more about the imminent challenge he's about to embark upon, cycling over 600 kilometres from London to Edinburgh.
At the end of August, my friend and I basically decided that we'd have all this holiday to use, and we need to do something that actually is, you know, beneficial for not just us, but trying to do something worthwhile with my holiday. So we kind of planned, we've been doing a little bit of cycling, so we've planned to anyway do something a bit crazy and cycle from our home in London and Dalston to my family home in Edinburgh.
So who's going to take part with you, and how prepared are you?
How prepared am I? We've been doing a bit. First of all, my best friend who I live with, we were kind of on a walk when we decided we were going to do this, and both our girlfriends was back at the house, so we came back to kind of explain to them our mad idea, and try to rope them into it. And I don't think either of them were jumped at it to start with, but we managed to bring them around. So both our girlfriends, my best friend James, who I live with, and his girlfriend who I also live with, and my girlfriend who lives down in the South London, and one of my other friends who's come across from Australia, he came across to kind of travel Europe, live here for a couple of years, and obviously with this COVID-19 situation, it's kind of scuppered a lot of his plans of traveling, so he wanted to come with it as well.
Brilliant. So how can people support these fundraising efforts?
We have a team name. I don't know whether we've got a Virgin Money giving page. Yeah. We've raised about £5,500 and £6,500 with gift aid so far. And be great to, you know, get some more support through that in terms of monetary donations, but also just, you know, just kind of any sort of messages or anything for us is very motivational for us to keep going. And it's going to be a tough ride with there. We've never actually done 7 days on the bike consecutively, so that's going to be the toughest. It's not the comfiest of things to sit on, so especially road bikes. So as you can imagine, that's going to be most tough. But our team name is Ride to Raise, LDN to EDI. So if you want to come and see more of our story, please try and search that and use that as a hashtag, and you can support our funds there.
Yeah, there's a link from our website, I believe, and it's on Virgin Money Giving, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. There is a link, because there was a news article done about us on your website, and there's a link there as well.
So what made you choose Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation as your charity?
I wanted to find a charity that was that you could actually see where the kind of money that you'd been fundraising was going. I liked on the TRWF website, you could see the price of some of the research that they were doing, and that would kind of originally set us a goal of what we wanted to raise. I know some of them are slightly more than what we're planning to raise, but at least we could see where our money is going there. And I think the research part of diabetes and living, but also the educational part of it is the most important right now to try and really find a cure, but also find the best way that diabetics can live.
Yeah, yeah. And you're also supporting another charity. Can you tell us about that one and why?
Yeah, we are. So we're supporting the Black Curriculum, which endeavours to educate future generations on Black history and culture, and incorporates into the school curriculums in the UK. So they kind of provide specialist teacher training, and programs for children from 8 to 16 years old. What they're trying to do is kind of promote social change and a sense of identity across every young person in the UK, no matter the race. So as kind of, we are 5 white privileged individuals, and we thought we wanted to do our utmost to support the movement, given the recent events, and promote this kind of social change that we spoke about.
Mm. So what do you think the biggest challenge is going to be on the ride?
I think the biggest challenge will be, there'll be multiple, obviously, but the biggest challenge will be getting to the bottom of the Northumberland Hills and looking up, thinking, I've got a couple of days of this. It's pretty flat up until Northumberland, and then it gets quite hilly, especially getting over into the borders into Scotland. The thing is about cycling is, although you get physically tired, you get so mentally tired as well. And so when we get to the sort of B&Bs or whatever we're stopping, we're going to be flat out. So I think mentally, but also physically, it's going to be tough.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
Our best wishes to Cameron. And if you'd like to support him, you can discover more via the news article on the DRWF website. And that brings us to the end of this edition of DRWF's podcast, Living with Diabetes. To keep up to date with the latest news and information, or to discover how you can continue to support DRWF at this challenging time, please visit the website at drwf.org.uk. This is Claire Levy from Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. Our thanks to all the people who talked to us, and also to you for listening. I'm looking forward to joining you again in our next edition of Living with Diabetes.
Living with Diabetes is a Blue Aurora Media production for DRWF. Copyright 2020. Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. All rights reserved.